And I don't want to absorb time with any sort of discussant role here. I just perhaps pose a couple of provocative, perhaps, or, you know, the usual cheeky come from somewhere else kind of question. So what do we do with these older spatial imaginations would be what I say to you. So here we've brought in a new range of spatial thinking through, as you suggest, reach, not height, as a way of approaching the spatiality of the state. And I'm profoundly convinced to find it something that I feel is very useful in all sorts of things I think about. So we can move on to different kinds of spatial imaginations, or we could take something, as Joe has done, take a very traditional and long-standing geographical concept like territory and run it through new kinds of philosophical and theoretical approaches. And where do we end up? Somewhere that almost seems contradictory, somewhere the opposite. The territory you knew, is this now deterritorialization? And I suppose I still really need for you to explain that, not being a Deleuze head. I think it would be helpful perhaps just to talk through what's the implication of that claim that the smooth space that we conventionally understand as a territory might be described as deterritorialization. I don't really understand what that would mean. So just at a simple level to help us understand that. And in terms of the embrace a new spatial imagination for theorizing the state, the older ones, they still hang around and remain useful, I wonder, in certain sorts of contexts. So you might have reach and proximity going on, but then what about those moments when one has an absence from certain traditionally understood scales or territories? So the national state, for example, might choose to operate literally at a national level with agents and actors who see themselves as operating at a national level, and the local may just be abandoned, be seen to be irrelevant and not worth engaging with. And I would certainly characterize a lot of how the South African state engages with economies and cities to be like that, that actually it's a terrain where there's precious little convergence of interest or desire to act at certain periods in South Africa's local government history. And I suspect if you think historically through the British state, you might find the scalar imagination more useful, you know, than a mapping of institutional authority onto spatial organization in that form might well be something to be thought relevant. And finally, you may choose to disconnect or to operate, to construct a scalar world of political authority and action. You may be fundamentally unable to be present in context. So reach may be minimal, meaning that one operates at a certain scale of political authority, which has a certain territorial boundedness, because you have no ability to engage in those different kinds of presencing actions that reach involves. So just wondering whether, as we move on, we still need to take our old theoretical baggage with us to continue to make sense of a range of different phenomena. So that's my kind of question. Okay, what I suggest we do is take little bundles of questions for who's here, a number of people, questions I'm sure there are. We don't have a lot of time. So if you can try and keep them quite focused, we'll take three or four and then ask the panel to respond. Is that okay? Sophie, yes.
I'm very convinced by this kind of way of thinking about reach. I'm wondering to what extent this theoretical paradigm that you're proposing relates to, if you like, a kind of real change in the way that the state's organising itself. In other words, is it reflecting that, or is this theoretical paradigm one that you think would have been just as useful to apply, you know, however long back one wants to look, 20, 30 years or 10? Or is it, in other words, are you mapping it on something new, or could you map it onto something else?
I think it's a question about the spatial and scalar imaginaries, but in a slightly different register, which is, suppose we put everybody through a critical geography course. Then do spatial and scalar imaginaries disappear because we know that they're all assemblages? And so it is, as it were, what are the conditions... What are the conditions rather than the causes of effect? Do effects require people who believe in the effectiveness of effects? Because we are cleverer than ordinary people, and I worry about this about all critical social and cultural sciences. We are cleverer than ordinary people, and we know that they are only effects, but other people think they're real. And I have an uncertainty about what ordinary people might think about states. and regions and economies and people who try and count them. Do people really believe that gross value added, if you turn it into a it's the number thing, if you turn it into a number, do people believe in its existence? Possibly not. Anyway, I'm sorry, that's a certain existential academic anxiety. I wish to be kept in employment because I'm cleverer than they are.
This is virtually John's question, but it's not really about ordinary people not getting things. I think you might be a bit unfair to theorists of scale in particular, and maybe actually all three of you more generally. One of the things which worries me about this conversation is that sort of a failure to think about what the grammar of space talk or space concepts are really getting at. So when theorists of scale talk about above and below, they don't really think the state is actually above the scale. They're using that language to talk about the relative effectiveness actually of different agents, aren't they? So we can unpick the next point of those ways of thinking. But what we end up doing is, it seems, putting back in their face another metaphor. In what, in this case, for example, of the near and the far, which does lots of work. As the person who had to write that chapter for the course, I'm quite keen on Beach. But it doesn't seem to me that actually the key issue is whether one replaces one set of spatial concepts with another set of spatial concepts, not least since it doesn't seem that spatial concepts are really about whether things are vertical or horizontal, but anyway, they're actually about something else.
In both presentations, one thing that struck me is the absence of law in constitutional territory. At the level of social relations, we might investigate the ways in which power, authority, and other words you use have possibilities of reaching out, drawing within reach, and so on. But law and its cognate or associated concept, jurisdiction, have material inscriptions on space that institute things that you're critical of, such as scale, such as hierarchy, such as non-overlapping, contiguous, discontiguous spaces. These are not just simply concepts that are discussed by geographers to describe the world, but actual realities inscribed in spaces by law and jurisdictions. So I guess I would want to hear from both presentations some reflections on the way in which law inscribes these things in space.
Thanks. Those are four great questions. Who wishes to go? Joe?
Well, can I take that Engin's question first, because that does provide an in for me to perhaps clarify some of the things that you were asking about, Jenny. The idea of material inscriptions in the world is exactly what I mean when I'm talking about I kind of need my diagram here, but the bunch of stuff that was on the right of the diagram is exactly the material inscriptions in the world. So I think you're absolutely right on that. One of the effects or one of the consequences of the effect that we call territory is exactly those kinds of inscriptions. So, we can't decide that the map that I had of the regions is different than it is. You know, it's that those boundaries are there by effectively by law, by state fiat, but they are also, I think, in an important sense, virtual. I mean, you know, when you drive across the land, you don't see a a big black line, at least not in the case of these lines. So, this one. So, I would place the law here. I would place legal instruments here. And I would place their material effects here. And it's the same in that sense with what I was saying about GVA. Value is here. Public accounting practices are here. And the movement of money in the establishment of development projects is here. And you could do the same kind of thing with, you know, a number of different manoeuvres. So it's not, with respect to John's question, it's not that this is more real and that the poor deluded saps who live over here haven't spotted it yet. This is just as... one of the important claims that Deleuze makes is that that's the real, right? It's not a distinction between the real and the virtual, or the real and the ideal. It's a distinction between the virtual and the actual, and they're both part of the real. So I don't see, although I didn't talk about the law directly, there is something about jurisdiction in the written paper as it happens, but although I didn't talk about the law directly, I think that that's consistent. I think your point is consistent with the framework that I'm trying to develop, but I haven't got there yet. At least in terms of this presentation. Do you want me to respond to your totally point? The point about it, you know, is it, can this be true that territory isn't territory anymore? The point that I take from this, and this is highly schematized and would give any serious Deleuzian a nightmare, I would imagine. But the point is not that these are synonyms. This is a group of cognate concepts. This is a group of cognate concepts. They don't mean the same thing. But as I understand it, in this schema, a re-territorialization is almost any kind of material actualization or material object. So, you know, the proverbial philosopher's table is a territorialization in this sense, as is, you know, this building, the university, and so on. And over here, absolute deterritorialization is, you know, the possibility of table and so on and so forth. So let me translate that into very, very briefly into the things that I was talking about just now. My university has just formed a partnership with the Regional Development Agency in the northeast of England to establish a series of community development projects across County Durham. It's called the Phoenix Programme. It involves several million pounds of public money being channeled into some of the poorest communities in the country in order to promote community participation in economic development. Okay? That is a territorialisation, okay? Because it involves the establishment of activities, meetings, community centres, new practices, new investments, actual practices, okay? But in the terms of the spatial concepts that we've been talking about, it's actually a network. Okay, it's a set of networked relationships. But in this schema, it's a territorialisation. How does it come about? It comes about in part because the Northeast gets more public, channeling of more public money through mechanisms like calculation of GVA and other statistical measures, which rely on something over here, which is the idea that a territory of the northeast of England can be poor, okay, or in need of development. So it's in that sense that, you know, the re-territorializations that are going on over here are actually the networked social interactions and the material inscriptions on the fabric of County Durham, but they rely upon, if you like, a notion of territory which is of a smooth space, of a kind of homogeneous field that can be, as it were, generically in need of development. So it's in that sense that territory over here is network in one sense, and the territory that we, you know, the classical geographical notion of territory, the bounded jurisdictional space, is actually over here.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes it at all clearer.
Yeah. Just to clarify on that side, though, you could have your woven territory as a woven fabric.
Well, this is, yes, exactly. So the question...
Beyond the bridge.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the membrane territory. This is territory as membrane, as completely continuous, as completely immanent in a sense. And this is the woven version of the fabric, which is differentiated. It is striated. It is. It has porosity.
Great. Thanks, Joe. Shall we move on? Do you want to pick up on some other questions?
Just pick up on the politics of that. Because one of the things, I mean, Jenny's point, really, one thing is what happens to the older spatial imaginarism. When you're trying to be evangelical about a particular kind of concept, you tend to go over the top. You know? If we just said, well, there's a bit of scale, scale's important, but we like this term topology, then no one would listen in one sense. But we've been very careful to make a distinction in everything we've written between between the politics of scale and an ontology of scale. We don't mention the ontology of scale, but we're very keen on the politics of scale, which is the ability of different groups to mobilise around a particular boundary. On the left, the spirit space. So it's not as if, but if you have an argument that the southeast is an assemblage which works through in topological ways through the actors that are assembled there, none of that means to say there's no such thing as scale. What we're saying is that the contest over where you draw the line, that what is the southeast, is a political contest. Involves the politics of scale between different groups coming up with different geographical imaginaries, but the people and the groups and the forces doing that work aren't necessarily bounded by the same scale or the same boundary, the region itself. They're a product of assemblages that cut across those spaces, outside, inside, beyond, and making that distinction between the two. The politics of scale is something that we think is very important because that's actually what goes on. Is contested. That's in the left, as I understand it, and the kind of the assemblage that we're talking about, the southeast, and the topology or network, whichever, you know, because they're not necessarily the same thing, but the network versions and topological senses of how actors practice their politics would be on the right in this kind of argument. So we're very careful in the sense that we're not saying this replaces the two, but it comes down to something that, you know, something that's always been the case. Within the department, it depends on what the question is. It's not as if topology answers everything and scale nothing. So, you know, it depends on what you're looking for and what you're arguing about. And in this case, we're thinking through, in what way has there been an altered geography of state power? And in our view, topological accounts help us in that way, but whilst retaining the politics of scale. Can you add anything to that?
Can you pick up another thing? That'd be good. Thanks.
I mean, which in a way, this does sort of... build on where you just ended up, because I think one of the issues, just coming to Sophie's point, I think what we're doing in a sense is a reaction to a particular debate. I think that were we to want to relate it historically, we might be able to do so. I don't think we're necessarily saying that this is something brand new and that, you know, you can't use these similar ways of thinking of the past. But I think it probably is important that we think that thinking the way that we've been doing, or developing the ideas that we've been doing, as John said, actually does help us to understand some of the changes that are taking place. But that's not to say that you couldn't have used it in the past. It's not to say that in the past scale was okay and now it isn't. I mean, because we actually, as John has just said, we think scale does still have a useful role and can still be used in terms of thinking about politics and the way it's constructed, but we would want to do that. So I think that's one of the things. I think I don't know that we think that, first of all, John combined spatial and scalar imaginaries, which I thought was an interesting thing to do. I think we're not necessarily getting rid of spatial imaginaries. I think we like to think that we still have at least some of them. We've also indicated how we think scale might still be useful. I don't think they disappear. I think we think there are useful ways, these are useful ways of starting some discussions. What I think what we do want to say is that they can't be taken for granted. Now, I take Clive's point that maybe we are caricaturing some people, we're suggesting that stuff was taken for granted even when it wasn't. But actually, what we are starting from is actually a very sophisticated understanding of scale. Our view is that it's so sophisticated that it no longer works. In other words, some of the things that Clive would want to retain, we think actually are lost in the most sophisticated contemporary versions of scalar thinking. Because it is so complicated, it is so mosaic-like, it is so overlapping, it is so entangled, that you think, well, where are the scales in all this? And we don't actually think it helps in resolving that problem to put territory, nation, whatever it was, scale and region together. So that's our starting point. So we're not... I mean, if we... So that's one of the things that we wanted to say about that. The other thing about whether the scales are about state, right? I think what we are concerned about is that quite often state and nation get conflated. And in scalar terms, it's the nation that's the top. But in practice, in much discussion, it turns out that that's also the state. That's where we would argue that some confusion sometimes arises. But it doesn't always. But it's very easy to slip between them, I think. That's why. And that's why Timothy Mitchell's work is particularly helpful in terms of highlighting that. I was interested by the notion of the question of law. I was trying to think why we haven't talked about it. I think there's very good reasons, because I don't
want
to
focus on
it. But it was also making me think about what if I go back to the empirical. I think one of the things that's interesting is for us is precisely the way in which attempts are being made by public agencies, which in a sense are the creatures of law and are pursuing law, are trying to go beyond the taken for granted, the apparently inscribed thing. So Joe suggests that the inscribed regions exist, and they're not law, but that's what's there. It's not been agreed, I think, by Parliament, but it's been agreed by whoever it was that agreed it. But actually, what's interesting when you look at the South East is that the very people who you might expect to be defending those legally inscribed borders are subverting them. They are suggesting they don't work anymore. No? So in that sense, I think there's something very interesting going on there. And I do accept that thinking about law and law-type behaviour or law speak would be very helpful in terms of thinking about some of the things that we've been trying to approach. I think it does open up a different way of thinking about it.
Thanks, Alan. All right, let's take another round of questions. I've got one. Yeah, great.
That's interesting. Just now, I was mulling over it and worrying slightly about the sort of methodology and just thinking about the nation. Because when we started, you talked about territory, the way I'm thinking of it is much, much more in relation to securitocracy and military and global and so on. Mm-hmm. Then you just said the nation is at the top and then region comes under that. But what about European regions? What about the... I mean, I know you don't sort of think that's the end of it, but, or the beginning of it, the national state, and then everything happens under that umbrella. But how does it work when you open it out to thinking about Europe and all kinds of different maps to do with development, to do with sustainability, to do with NATO? How does the concept stand up?
Great, thanks, Ron. Steve?
Thanks, Ron. Two questions, I think. First, I'm really struggling to visualise a topology that's not flat. I'm really struggling. If you're a topologist, I think you're flat. And I'm not sure that you're not flattening in some ways while you're holding on. I mean, if, you know, the kind of common critique of that kind of style of the Flat Earth Society is to sort of say, well, we can accept that there are some things bigger than others, but we're not saying that's the origin, that they're made, they're constructed. So how is your argument different than that? How can you visually describe a topology that's not flat? The other one, I was just struck by both papers, is that they both start in a kind of conceptual purification mode in some ways. Then they move into practices, which were the really interesting bit. And then we've got polyvalences, accommodation, adaptation, mess, multiplicity, all these great terms that I really like. And then at the end you give us reach or something more pure. And I just wonder why not stay with the practices and kind of work with those. There's an academic style here, which is a little bit pure, maybe, which I guess is something or someone saying something.
Okay, I saw some hands in here.
I've got a question to Alan and John as well, which is kind of along the old fashioned concepts. I was wondering if the concept of hegemony, how you pronounce it, in your view, contributes anything to the question of bringing into reach and how this whole dynamic of who brings what into reach is functioning. And then I've got a sort of in between question and suggestion for Joe to pick up the Deleuzian fold again. The first part of it would be to include Guattari, to whom some of these concepts are actually owed, yep, rather than Deleuze. So if you pick up one of those, maybe it would be rather Guattari than Deleuze. And the other thing, that in Thousand, they actually tended to write about the territory, and you just put them on the side of DNP territorialization and not of their concept of territory. And that's especially, I think, has some relevance.
You mean territory as opposed, yeah, to re-territorialization? Territory specifically?
The relation between territory, yeah, and re-territorialization. Yeah. Because in the end of your paper, yeah, you actually, yeah, ask if there could be a relation between territory and assemblage.
Yeah.
And they actually explicitly, yeah, say that, yeah, assemblages are territorial,
yeah,
but that they are also defined by de-territorialization. Yeah. So that's the specificity of, yeah, assemblage. So that kind of...
Yeah.
And actually, they have a take of they're mobilizing ecology, but in a different way. Yeah, they're using it in a way not to kind of equate it with aggressive, yeah, boundary making. They criticize that take, yeah, within ecology, but they still use it, so that, yeah, brings into complication.
Yeah, sure.
Great, thanks. David?
Yeah. I just wanted to disengage slightly with that distinction that you've done, and Alan, you've drawn between sort of politics of scale that you kind of endorse to an extent, and an ontology of scale that you reject. And I'm wondering if I think it's a kind of useful way of moving beyond some of the kind of impasse around some of those debates, but I wonder if it's possible to neatly kind of reject the ontology of scale whilst embracing the politics of scale. And also, linking back into what Steve was saying, and John, the kind of messiness of the ways in which those kind of notions of scale get mobilised politically, I just think kind of undermine some of these sort of categorisations of scale a wee bit.
Great. Okay, I'll take, you can try and, I know there's a lot to talk about, and try and keep your responses relatively focused and brief, and we'll have time for one last round of questions. So think of your last question if you've got something coming up in your head.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you for those comments. I think that's spot on. I mean, one of the problems with A Thousand Plateaus, of course, is that it's so such a kind of diverse text that it's probably possible, impossible, and no doubt deliberately so, to produce something that's kind of consistent with every with every shift of the work. So, but I will revisit that. That's very helpful. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, thanks for that. On the your question about the international military section issues, I mean, that's very much how territory has been read in, certainly in my field of political geography. Historically, it's been equated with nation state territories and with questions of international relations. And in fact, there was a case. It was a kind of slightly bizarre experience when we were trying to, in the department where I work, we were trying to come up with a name for the predecessor for the centre that I now am involved in at Durham. And somebody suggested the Centre for the Study of Territorial Development, and it was rejected by the head of department, who was not a social scientist, on the grounds that it had militaristic connotations, and that was to a lay person in this kind of setting. He immediately said, "Oh no, we can't have that. It's militaristic. It sounds militaristic to me." Of course, that is very strong current within these debates. What I wanted to do was to, in a sense, to disrupt that by trying to look at administrative territories and to see in what sense they still function as territories in the way that I defined them. So, in other words, to take a test and more of a kind of more of a challenge to territorial thinking in a way, to take something that was less conventionally defined strongly as a territory. But I think you could take the same kind of methodology and apply it exactly the same. In other words, I mean, I would see, military organisations are also made up of these kinds of territory-making practices, if you like. They're not intrinsically distinctive in that way. So that would be my response there. On to Steve and purification, mea culpa. I think that this comes about because of a kind of anxiety about terms that get over. In this case, it came about because of an anxiety over the overextension of a term that becomes so widely used as to be, as you think, well, what does this mean? What's this giving us anymore that's distinctive? And so that, now, there's a very fine line then to be drawn between trying to unpack that term and give it precision on the one hand, and slipping into a kind of essentialism or purism on the other. But I think in a way, despite the tenor of the talk, I guess, I think in a way what I am trying to do is to show how the territories that people do talk about out there in the world, the messy spaces that people refer to as territory in their routine practices, are generated not through some kind of essentialist territoriality, but through exactly these kinds of messy practices. So I think, I'm trying to walk that tightrope.
Thanks. Ellen, either of you?
Let's pick up on that same one then. Steve's point. Picking up on the pure and the messy. I think I echo what Joe's saying in the sense that when you're trying to work through something, for me it's not enough just to know you're in the middle of something. So you're in the middle of the assemblage is one of those terms that allows you to talk about the mess of relations in a way that can bring up different temporalities, practices, specialities, all kinds of ways. But if you want to grasp it, for me, I mean, that's sort of kind of an old-fashioned sense of conceptualization. What is actually going on there? For me, that involves throwing away information. It involves a process of purification of your language and an examine conceptualization of the old language of realism. I don't have a problem with that so much. It's not a difficulty for me in that kind of thing. It doesn't mean to say that there isn't a mess out there. Now, in this particular case, I think what you're saying is it's reducing the notion of topology to reach, in one sense. Topology, as I think most people know, is a branch of mathematics. It's a branch of mathematics that's an advance on geometry. It's often referred to as plasticine geometry or rubber sheet geometry. It's been evocative already, rubber sheet, plasticine. Yeah? And it's the
ability of motion.
And what they want mathematicians work with are shapes, effectively, that are bent, are twisted, are folded, are stretched. And whatever you do to a particular shape, think of a ball of plasticine, it retains its invariant properties. Now, in the language of AMT, that's pretty close to immutable mobiles, actually, which I don't particularly buy into. But the point, what you're getting at here, is something very malleable that can be twisted, shaped, and folded in all kinds of ways. But actually, the properties, the mathematical properties you're looking for, remain the same. And this, there's always a danger when you take that kind of argument and turn it into something social. You're saying, where's the invariant properties?
But I think what we're saying here is the power relations we're talking about can get, in that language of stretch, folded and twisted, can actually retain, it can be authority, or it may not be, it might go through a negotiation, it might actually be, it may allow manipulation to be more effective by being twisted. Now the problem, if you just stay at the level, I'm trying to be quick, if you just stay at the level of folding, bending, twisting, then it's quite evocative, there's a series of metaphors, but it's very hard to convince people to have an audience. By focusing on reach was an attempt, in a sense, to actually, because most people already have a sense of spatial reach out there, to rework that in a topological rather than a topographical way. And where I think that this relates to your first question about you can't think of topology outside of being flat. The examples that we've discussed and have been around, and have been discussed in the department between ourselves, paper by Mould and Law, regions networks and fluids, or for those who know it, the discussion between Bruno Latour and Michel Serre, where there's this very evocative five lines of a handkerchief, where the handkerchief is out there and describing topology actually two places, two points, and you put them together and they are now what the previously distant is now close to each other proximate. And this is an attempt, I think it's a laudable attempt and an analogy to get across. But the point is, that's already topographical. It doesn't work. It's not about the folding handkerchief. The folds don't work because you can't fold topography. You can measure it, draw it, all those kinds of things.
Topography.
So it's actually it's a misleading analogy in that sense. But it also creates the impression of flatness. So to a certain extent as networks, so to a certain extent as fluids. And actually when you go back this way, both the plasticine and the rubber geometry, to actually get a sense of where you're talking about a set of transverse relationships, which are, they're not transverse, means neither hierarchical nor horizontal in that sense. They just cut across, cut through. It's all right.
No, fascinating and helpful. So, anybody want to come back with the last couple of? Alan, I didn't.
I just thought I should say something about the national vision. I'm using scale to be doing it myself. But actually, I do think that what we've been talking about works for European institutions as well as it does for others. So, and in fact, some of our thinking originally in our previous paper drew on and criticised the model of governance, which were originally developed in the context of the European Union. So I think that's the magic thing you can do that. There were a couple of other things that how would be this hegemony, how would hegemony fit in? I think it would fit uneasily with our particular approach. I mean, it's possible that there might be hegemonic processes, but I think what we would be arguing is a bit on the subtle. These things are actually difficult to maintain. That's why we think there are stable power formations. Now, that may, I suppose the other thing I would say is that would be a critical question. I think we could write off the possibility that it might happen, but I think we would be slightly dubious about it. So actually, just in, one of the things we've tried to say in the paper is we've used the notion of quantum as a way of getting beyond flat or hierarchical, but I'm not sure it works. But it's an attempt to bring some of the things that John's talking to as well.
Great, thanks. Any final questions? Yes.
If I'm allowed one.
Yes, please.
Okay. I'm very pleased to see the word organisation in the title of your paper. Everybody, I'm an organisation theorist. I don't think I've ever met one before. This is what one looks like. We read the LERS and things like that, even though we work in business schools. I was very interested to hear you grappling with the problem of organisation using spatial notions, which is basically John and Alan's paper, using sort of spatial notions to grapple with organisation. It's really, really, really hard to do because organisation theorists cannot do space. They don't think spatially at all. I don't think it's right to, because in many ways space does not explain organisation and organisation does not explain space in its entirety. But what I was really interested in is this sort of notion of the reach of the state, particularly in terms of power. And I was wondering why you chose the term institution and what you mean by the term institution. And I wonder if the kind of Bowker style notions of infrastructure would be helpful.
The who's style notion?
Bowker and Starr's stuff on infrastructure.
Okay. Good. Phil?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm clever enough to turn this into a question.
Comment will be very welcome.
Just wanted to try to think through, partly stimulated by Vron's comment about the international. I think something that might kind of be an interesting test or application in the way you're thinking is Ronan Pallan's book on the offshore world, which articulates how states were complicit, and the British state in particular, with allowing certain places to set themselves up as offshore financial centres, which, though in one sense they're potentially under state sovereignty, are kind of allowed to slip sideways, to be left alone, to run themselves, and that actually these little places were very much embroiled in globalisation, because they were used to put pressure on other states. And I think that, you know, I think your way of kind of trying to deal with place, territory, scale making processes is a bit limited if it just stays at the kind of British state level, because there is that easy assumption that the national state rules. And of course, we know now that the national state doesn't quite rule. But in the case of the British state, it's interesting the way that with one hand, parts of the British state were encouraging small island states to become financial centres, while other parts of the British state were saying, no, hold on, you know, this is actually going to erode our power. So I think, you know, in terms of the kind of the complexities of the way that spaces and non-spatial interests work, but that's actually a really interesting case
study. Okay, thanks, Bill. Great. Any final, Nick? Yes. Okay. Quick.
No pressure.
Time's up.
It's just a question about whether it's kind of slightly a meta question about what we're after here. There's no tension, particularly from various questions, the tension here between trying to kind of legislate and specify and say this is a new or a better way of thinking about this or that or the other. And so that's been going on in parts of the papers. And another part of the paper, there's also this thing about seeing that, to say there's lots of things going on, there's a kind of multiplicity of practices and so on and so forth. And so are we trying to think of the relationship between those things? So, you know, like the question is reach actually a kind of intertopological effect of modern world, we call it, rather than anthropology? Are we looking for, say, there's lots of things going on in the world, it's not this or that or the other, so how do we think about those partial connections between those things, or are we trying to find, like, a new way of saying, no, you're all wrong, it's like this?
You get that?
I mean, the legislators versus interpreters. I mean, you know as well as I do. Yeah, I mean, you know as well as I do that we don't think that topology is the only answer, the rest is rubbish. I mean, it would be an absurd position to adopt in any particular way. But it reflects something that partly with Sophie's gone now, but her question is whether, now partly answered it, whether topology is something new or just we could have used it in the past. Of course, as Alan said, you know, it wasn't invented in the 1990s, but it's possible that some of the shifts in transport telecommunications actually facilitate some kind of topological understanding or topological shifts in the architecture of globalisation. So the questions that are being asked now are different from the questions that were asked 20 years ago. Different sets of ideas in different contexts may be more useful to answering those particular questions. The idea that you could have a set of concepts that would be blanket, that could be useful for anything, I think most of us around the table would accept that that's not the case. But equally, I mean, the contrast I would use, which is not the position I think coming from the kind of notion of the messiness of social relations, is where you get the Bob Jessop et al. Paper, where you try to put together territory, scale, network, and place as if it's a piece of addition. As if you can have social sets of relations and add space in, and in this case, mix up the four and put them on top. And one of the things we've done collectively over the years in the department is to talk about the way in which space makes a difference. You don't just add it on. It's not background, it's not context. It actually makes a difference to the sets of social relations you're looking at. And that already gives you a mess, but coming back to the part of the answer, the response to Steve's, there's particular ways, particular sets of concepts to deal with particular sets of questions. It doesn't legitimise a vocabulary that says, this is the answer. So, you know, going back to Bauman, we're all interpreters, we know that in that sense. Yeah, but, and those interpretations are disputed, as they should be in any context.
Great. Okay, final points from anybody else?
But just on the, you know, the question of what this is for, I suppose, you know, for me, in relation to my paper, the world has been structured using the concept of territory in very profound ways. I mean, this is effectively what Engin was saying, and that has incredibly significant consequences. I mean, people lose their lives, they lose their jobs, they gain their jobs. You know, incredible things happen as a result of that. So, you know, I think one of the things that we can do as social scientists, as geographers, is to say, well, what are the conditions of possibility that allow the world to be understood in that way? And I think that's really what I was trying to do. So whether it's, you know, I mean, of course, the question of whether it helps in that to engage in a kind of process of conceptual purification is, in a sense, a methodological question. But I think that's what this is about in a kind of grand way, grandiose way, perhaps, grand way. But can I just very, very briefly respond to an earlier point that John made, because I've just remembered something I wanted to say about that, about who believes in GVA. Okay. You'd be surprised.
I'm open for being surprised, John.
I've been to a lot of seminars where if the people speaking don't believe in it, they are very, very good at pretending. Okay. But they are also public accountants, and the authors of that handbook have a fantastically sophisticated understanding of it. So they understand its limitations, they understand its ambiguities and its incoherences and so on, and they can actually deploy that and improve it and recognise that it's an historical construct as well. So these are, of course, they're experts, and they have expertise and they have knowledge, and they are fully aware, but at the same time they do also mobilise the terms as if they were real, as if they had, which they do have real effects. And if I can just finish with an anecdote, my sister, I spent last night staying at my sister's flat in London, and she has an MBA from the Open Business School, and she told me that one of the things she learnt on her MBA course was that the secret of being a good manager is the capacity to believe two contradictory things at the same time.
Did you teach that?
Okay, Alan, final, if you don't mind being quick.
I mean, first of all, the issue about institutions and infrastructure. I mean, I think the reason we've used the notion of institutions is partly because what we were looking for, what we're interested in, it actually relates to something that Phil said as well. I mean, we're interested in scale making processes, we're also interested in
Institute. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be thinking about it. Can I come back very quickly?
Extremely.
Okay, but it was my understanding of institutions is it a concept that tends to do stasis rather than change, whereas the infrastructural. I don't know.
That may be from an organisational studies. I don't think in every area of the social
Can I suggest that we take one more question?
I think there's a question actually, which is the one about the relationship between with the British state or not the British state. I mean, we have not, our view of the British state is not that it's a unified whole. I mean, one of the things we've argued, I think, quite strongly in the paper, that the sort of divisions that Phil has identified in the British state, precisely we would identify them within institutions as well as between them. And I think that's one of the things that we would want to discuss. And in that context, I think one of the things we've also tried to argue is that one of the things that really matters, even at local or regional level, is the ability to appeal beyond the boundaries of the particular state, to draw in other ways of thinking, other possibilities, other opportunities, in order to construct something which becomes a regional center, which is part of the process. So it's not that we think that these things are captured. I mean, that would be inconsistent with our broad. Yeah. Just on reach, I just want to say something about reach and messiness. I think our notion of reach is really quite messy.
Well, thank you.